Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
The Poodles were so late that we went on at 2, and that was the point when the Jam was supposed to be on. So everybody coming into the theatre expecting to see the Jam, they saw these punsets in a Jam. Coming on to entertain that we got howled off. In Downton, when I left Lady Edith at the altar,
yes.
I had some vicar came up to me and said, how could you have done that? You know, and I thought, it wasn't me. They always say at the end of an obituary, he leaves 3 children by his first marriage or whatever. And his, in that one, as penned by him, he said, he leaves 2 unwritten books and a circle of detached acquaintances.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a star of stage and screen who went from life as an always in-work jobbing actor a household name in the late 90s after his brilliant portrayal of hapless David Marsden in the award-winning comedy drama Cold Feet. Born in Ghana in 1957, where his father was working as a management consultant, the family moved to Ireland when he was 2, and it was there he attended boarding school before moving to school in Sussex and then on to Cambridge, where he studied law, which is where he became part of their world-famous student comedy troupe, Footlights, working alongside the likes of Hugh Laurie, Stephen Fry, Emma Thompson and Jimmy Mulville. After graduating, he was qualified to work as a barrister, but instead went on tour with Footlights for a year in Australia, and upon his return, never practiced law. Instead, he started working as a stage actor, going on to make his television debut in the never-broadcast pilot episode of Blackadder. In his 20s, he had to make up fake credits on his CV, shows like The Odd Thing and Loads of Tosh, for example, which to this day he still uses alongside some rather more impressive real ones, including Downton Abbey, Red Dwarf, Joking Apart, Doctor Who, and even Posh Bloke in Westlife's Uptown Girl video. Now 66, he has 4 daughters, all grown up with his wife, the artist Victoria Threffel, and they live together in Sussex, although he's spending rather a lot of time in Soho at the moment, and Geoffrey Bernard is unwell, playing one of Soho's most notable and notorious locals, with shows that have featured Saturday evening performances that start at midnight, followed by a traditional Soho lock-in until 5 a.m. Blimey, let's find out how he's faring in the face of these all-nighters. It's Robert Bathurst. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Kate. Lovely to see you.
Were you doing a Soho lock-in last night?
Yeah, it wasn't lucky. I did two shows last night. Last night was Monday night. And so I did two shows at 7 and 9. But no lock-in, though. It finishes very tastefully at 11 o'clock.
That is rather tasteful. Certainly, Geoffrey Bernard was not known to be in his bed much before midnight, was he?
But I did get dragged off to Jerry's Club, actually, by some people who had been at the show. I'd never been to Jerry's Club. I mentioned Jerry's Club in the show, and of course it was one of Geoffrey Bernard's regular watering holes, along with the French pub and the Colony Room and everything like that. He always started his day at the Coach and Horses, which is where I do the show. And yes, these people in the audience I'd never met before, as is in the proper Soho manner, say, go off to Jerry's Club. And so I went off to Jerry's Club for the first time, and they made me a member. So that's great. I suspect that that's the beginning of my downfall. There we are.
That's really the beginning of the end, Robert. explain to us what Jerry's is, because, you know, those that have frequented the mean streets of Soho may well have heard of it, but there's many that won't.
It's a basement in Dean Street, I think. It's just done from the French. And very friendly, and it's got a little sort of glittery stage there. It's green-painted walls with lots of photographs of people who've left their livers there. And it's a very convivial bar. That's what it is. And it's not dissimilar from when I did Toast of London. They did a mock-up of what they call the Colonial Club, which is a mock-up of a mixture between the Colony Room and Jerry's. And it has the same green paint as the Colonial Room, Colonial Club and Toast, which I'm very pleased to see.
I think that's the most fragrant description I've ever heard of Jerry's, because my understanding is it is a late-night lock-in for those that never want to go home. And what goes on in Jerry's stays in Jerry's.
I gather that is the rule, and I'm sure it's adhered to completely, yes, indeed. And no journalists from the Times can get hold of any stories in there, because they're staying.
I think, I had a friend, an actress friend of mine, Denise Welsh, who literally was probably one of their most frequent members. I do believe it was there that she met her husband at 6 a.m. on the dance floor. I mean, they're sober now. They don't go to Jerry's, but obviously fond memories.
That is the beginning of a fine relationship, yeah.
It actually was, but the beginnings were auspicious, to say the very least. speaking of auspicious, Geoffrey Bernard. I mean, this is a hell of a piece of work, because originally this is the Keith Waterhouse play. It was originally staged with Peter O'Toole taking the role that you play as Geoffrey, but with three other cast members, and you've shrunk this back and stripped it back, not for the first time, to be a one-man show, not played in a theatre, but played in the pub at which he propped up the bar every day from the moment it opened, really. How did you end up walking in Geoffrey's shoes?
Well, James Hillier, the director, and he adapted it for one person. And in November 19, arranged with the then publican there to put it on in the pub. The play was always set in the Coach and Horses. Keith Waterhouse, the playwright, took pieces from Geoffrey Bernard's articles in The Spectator. He wrote an article called Low Life, and Alexander Chancellor, commissioner, who's the editor of The Spectator, commissioned Geoffrey Bernard to write it, because he was genuinely low life, in the sense that he was genuinely on his uppers, because he drank it all and spent it all, and he needed to sort of hack it up by writing, keep some sort of a living going. He was also a writer for the Sporting Life. He was a great racing correspondent. But he wrote about life in the gutter in Soho, and for 15 years he managed to do this weekly piece for The Spectator, a piece described by Jonathan Meads as a 15-year suicide note. Because it was so true. It was probably a construction of himself he was writing. But so what Keith Waterhouse did was he collated stories from the low life pieces and managed to set it in the Coach and Horses on stage, with Peter O'Toole initially doing it, with I think it was three or four actors doing scenes from his life, the cat racing and all those other sort of things like that.
And cat racing. I think that might require some explaining.
Well, cat racing does feature in the version that I do as well. And so he's cut it down to an hour, and we do it actually in the coach. Yeah, I mean, the cat racing is one of the features. It's a sort of interactive piece with the audience. And it's because there's no racing. It's too hot, too cold for racing. So some louche figure comes into the pub and says, come racing in my flat in Battersea. And he's got this big flat in Battersea, and he races cats in it. And we managed to do it in the pub.
It sounds exactly like the sort of thing that daytime drinkers do, right?
It's the sort of thing that seems perfectly normal to daytime drinkers. it was originally a stage, a full hour, 1.5 hour stage show, which James Hillier has reduced to the hour, and I just go on my own and do it twice a night.
Twice a night.
Well, it's an hour, and then you get an hour off in between, and it means I pop down to see people who have come to see the show. I can't sort of hang around with them and too long, because there's another audience coming in within half an hour. But
you're in the run now. And they're off. I mean, I think it's pretty much almost sold out, isn't it, Robert?
It is selling out. It does sell out very well. But I mean, it's an occasional thing. I mean, it means that I've got it in my back pocket, as it were, to do when and if in between jobs. I can arrange with the producer. We can arrange to go to the coach and do 10 shows or whatever like that. So it's going to be an occasional thing. And there is a site where I can give you, just so that you get first call on any development of the show and when it goes on. So there's a thing called jeffreyplay.com. You go to that and you can register for that, and then you get first notice as to when the next shows are going to be. So it's an occasional gig, and it seems to go really well, and I just adore doing it.
I mean, you won't hear many stories like his anymore. I mean, he would be so cancelled in this day and age. There's no way that he would have retained employment. I mean, this man was, gosh, how can I describe him? I mean, pretty awful in places. You wouldn't want him as a husband. He was a chronic alcoholic, but yet there was such affection for him. What's your observation of how he managed to pull those two things off in tandem?
It's very complicated, really. I mean, he was married four times. There was a lot of damage along the way, I think. But women were drawn to him somehow. They all wanted to change him.
I think until his 50s, he was a very attractive man. And then suddenly his lifestyle caught up with him. I mean, he died with one leg and living alone in a room in Soho, didn't he? I mean, that was his preference, by the way. But up until his 50s, I think he certainly had the looks and the chat to pull it off, didn't he?
Well, absolutely. I mean, he was extremely witty. And so, but, I mean, the show is, in a sense, a celebration of Geoffrey Bernard's writing before 11 a.m. come opening time, he would be off to the coach and on his circuit to all the other watering holes. And then people would come into the coach, say at 2 p.m, and try and find him, and then go up to him, and knowing his articles, knowing how witty and how he could be, expecting him to be the same sort of person as he was in his writing. And they were generally seen off and very disappointed. Because he was when he was drunk, he wasn't quite the same person that he was writing as he was writing. He used to write semi sober. I mean, he used to write have a vodka and orange to in the mornings. But he would write relatively sober. And there's so many people in Soho who hang around and they get very drunk and they wonder why they can't write. And I think the key to a lot of the real soaks of Soho is that they do write sober. I mean, they do write sort of semi together, and then they get sunk. But there's a lot of people who get sunk and then wonder why they can't write. But so he is. Yeah, I mean, you say incorrect. I mean, he's of his time, perhaps. But you might say. Mm. But I did put out a trigger warning on the show, which is ironic because everything has to have a trigger warning now in case people are offended. And so I put out a trigger warning, which the Daily Mail took seriously, and they rang up in a great high dudgeon saying, why are you putting a trigger warning on it? Anyway, the trigger warning I put on the show was that this show contains references to smoking, gambling, alcohol and sex. And the Mail rang up and said, why are you doing this? And I said, well, I'm just ironically just putting out four perfectly legal adult activities, some people find shocking. I said, but most shockingly of all, the show also contains humour. Anyway, so they printed that. So finally, the Daily Mail got irony. But so the show is, yeah, it's fairly raw at times, and it's also about self-destruction, about self-determination, about somebody who's damned if they're going to be told how to lead their life. And he did the way he wanted to do it. He was a diabetic and he didn't take his insulin, and he did end up with gangrene and lost half his leg and was wheeled off between the various things, and people used to wheel him back from Groucho's at 2 a.m. and take him to his flat. And yes, it was a very sad and desperate end, but he lived life as he wanted to live it. And there was, of course, as he says in his piece, he writes a mock obituary to himself, which I recite in the play. And he said, and they always say at the end of an obituary, he leaves 3 children by his first marriage or whatever. And his, in that one, as penned by him, he said he leaves 2 unwritten books and a circle of detached acquaintances. and he sums his life up very well and very honestly.
And I love the fact that you kind of pop this in your back pocket as a one-man show that you can bring out whenever you need it in between gigs and jobs. So you're really making his work for you now.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, in the tradition of hustling.
Which takes me very nicely to my very first question for you, Robert. Hustling, that is. Can I dive in?
Yeah, dive.
In your early 20s, you landed a job as a television presenter on a show that was watched by 18 million people and would have made you not only very well known, but probably more importantly at that time, very well paid. And the job in question was to be one of the co-presenters on That's Life with Esther Ranson. But you turned it down because you said, "I knew if I took it, throughout my life, I would have been in these sort of interviews and I'd have been marked down as one of Esther's boys. And at that stage, I knew I wanted to act. And I knew that if I took it, it would change the perception of everything I did for the rest of my career. So I turned it down." Now, that is a pretty ballsy decision, especially for somebody who's gone on to describe acting as an existence of weekly disappointment and constant despair. So I wonder, what gave you the strength of conviction in that no at a time when there was nothing else on your table to say, this is a smart decision?
No reflection on Esther, because she ran this show and I enjoyed going through the audition process with her, and it would have been fun to do. And she ran this hugely successful show, which has had an audience far beyond anything anyone could ever dream of.
18 million, Robert.
Yesterday. I look back on that and I think, yeah, well done. Because, I did. I knew precisely what you as quoted there. I knew that if that would be the end of what I really want to do, which is what I'm doing at the moment, which is acting. And I think there is a difference between acting and presenting. I know now notoriety is everything, and you can. The important thing is to be seen in anything up to a point, and which, you know, I don't hold with completely, but it's how things are. And so, but in the environment then, you were much more in one track, acting and presenting would have swamped the other,
yeah.
And I knew I wanted to do what I do, and I knew I felt I could feel I had no real taste for presenting, and I enjoyed doing the audition, and it was fun, and I enjoyed journalistically sort of writing up a piece and presenting it to camera and all that. But it was such a powerful beast, That's Life, that I couldn't see the future that would not always colour everything I did in the context of being in that show. So, it was a very sort of mature foresight of this decision. It may or may not have been the right one. I don't know. But and who knows how life would have panned out if I had taken it.
So what year was that? And how old would you have been? And where were you at in your professional life?
It was
then?
About 1980, 82, I think it was, maybe 80, 81. But it was, I'd left university and I did the law for a year and doing shows all throughout that time and through that amp, and then did a radio series and then a comedy series, and sort of, you know, that was all that was going on. So I did, so yeah, to be offered that show And then I went into Noises Off, which was did a year in Noises Off, and I sort of thought, oh, thank goodness for that. You know, I'm sort of doing theatre. I mean, and at the end of the year, I only had two words on my CV, and so went and held a spear at the National, and I literally had one line for 4 months in St. Joan. In my chainmail and holding my spear, saying my one line, and musing on the fact that I could have taken that life, but I was happier doing that. And I was thinking, holding my spear, thinking I could be opening supermarkets by now. It never worried me. I never looked back from that decision. But it would have been fun to have parallel lives and do both. Would have been great fun.
Well, in this day and age, arguably you could. But I understand that back then it was pick a lane and stay in your lane. But I wonder where that kind of courage of conviction comes from, because, I mean, were you married at the time? Were you with Victoria? Had that happened? Or
no,
does this predate married life?
Yeah. And it was probably like 23, 24, around there sometime. We didn't meet until I was years later. But... no, and there was nothing settled. It was just instinct, really. I mean, I didn't have any other source of income, and I was sort of scratching around doing stuff. So yeah, there was. I don't know what drove that. I mean, I know what drives it. It drives it because it's where I feel, where I feel most comfortable doing what I do, and it seemed to be a sort of a departure which I didn't fancy at the time. But I remember at the audition. The exec producer said, we're going to offer it to you. And I said, well, I'm not sure. He said, is it the money? And I said, well, it's not that. I couldn't really describe it because it's not something that he'd ever understand. But I lied to St. Esther. I lied my way through the audition saying how much I wanted to do it.
You lied to Esther Ransom.
I lied to Esther Ransom. I know. But
God forgive you, Robert.
Yeah. And they gave me a story to present in the studio with her, which I had to research and then write and present. And it was all about the smelliest piggery in South Wales. And I had to ring up the people in this village of Bryth Wells. I'm sorry for the pronunciation. And they all got terribly excited, thinking they were going to be on That's Life. And I kept on saying, no, it's only my audition piece. Don't get so excited. But it all went through. I had several rounds of it, and I was happy to leave it behind. But it wasn't actually an option. It wasn't a difficult decision at all. But for whatever reason, and I don't know what the instinct that was driving it was, but that's what happened.
Probably the same instinct that saw you qualified to work as a barrister, but actually never practiced it. So you had this amazing fallback that should you ever need it was there, but you've never been tempted to step up to the bar.
No, I never saw it as a fallback. When I went did my interview at university for that place, I lied to my soon to be director of studies, a really delightful man called James Campbell, who supported me all the way through my time at the university and my flailing attempts to study law. And having said to him, It was a sort of an honour thing, really, because I went to the law school in London to do the bar qualifications whilst I was doing lots of other shows in the meantime, and just to prove to myself that I could actually apply myself to that task, to that discipline, and also to say to James, yeah, I did it, but I'm not going to do it anymore. So there was an element of that. I also had no idea about drama school. I had no in on that. I had no knowledge of anything to do with the profession. So all I knew was I wanted to do it. And I was doing lots of shows, university stuff, but I knew that wouldn't sustain for many more years after I left. So I had to find my way into doing plays and doing other things.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Well, let's talk about your university days, which takes me onto my next question for you, because you say you did some plays at university. I think they were slightly more substantial than you might be letting on, Robert. The Footlights Tour of Australia is the first, I'm guessing, professional tour that you took on, which saw you and a bunch of guys from Cambridge tour Australia in a show, I think, that was called Botham the Musical. Is that right?
It was in 1981, and that we went in November, and that summer, Ian Botham had done some heroics, especially at Headingley, to capture the ashes, and we were touring Australia, and so, I mean, the show wasn't about anything; it had no theme, and so provocatively we called it. I mean, everything now is called the musical, but in those days it wasn't. We called it Botham the Musical. And of course, which confused all the journos in Australia. We were taken by a pop promoter. There's a guy called Martin Bergman who was part of who set it all up and was in the show. He's now in Hollywood, in California. With he's married to Rita Rudner, the comedian, and he set up the show. He had a relationship with an Australian producer who normally did. Moscow State Circus and Billy Joel concerts and all sorts of stuff like that. So we got that, the sort of the pop treatment, and went all around Australia, everywhere apart from Darwin and Alice, to doing these shows, going on chat shows and living like kings, which wasn't the best introduction to how the profession really is, but it was fantastic. And we played all these huge theatres and went all over Australia, and it was fantastic, just huge fun. Yeah, it's great, really great fun. I mean, that was 2 years. That was a year or so after I left. And we toured around.
You're right. It isn't normal to step into a situation like that straight off the bat. But by that point, Footlights was a brand, I guess, in as much as people would pay to come and see the players of Footlights because it was establishment. It provided a springboard for so many great careers. Tell me a little bit more about that time on the road and being treated like pop stars, because you wouldn't normally go and sit on a chat show to promote a tour when you've got nothing on your CV, not even spear holding.
Well, quite. Yeah, it was. I mean, the actual society, the Comedy Society from Cambridge, has a tradition, and from it, for various people have emerged. It's all the sort of half of the Pythons and half Beyond the Fringe and things. So, and Stephen, Hugh and Emma had recently had a huge success. I'd left before, and they'd had a huge success in Edinburgh the year before with their show. And they were the next big thing on the block. And and Martin and I and Stephen, Hugh and Emma, we did the tour. So, I mean, the fact is we were very well promoted. I mean, we were over-promoted, if you like. But nonetheless, they were happy to have us on these networks chat shows, it seemed to be a great success. So we had an absolute ball. But I knew then also that I didn't want to hang around doing review. It was sketches and it was songs and stuff like that. And I knew I couldn't see anybody over 33 really doing review sketches. I mean, I agree. I mean, the Fast Show is still doing sketches, and they're 85. But it's
tell Harry Enfield you said that.
Yeah, I could tell him that. But so, but anyway, as far as I could see, that wasn't. I couldn't see the future in that, and I wanted to sort of get more into the sort of the mainstream swim of doing shows and plays and things like that. So I didn't sort of carry on with that, and but had this agent and then went my way doing as I say doing play in the West End and then Holding a Spear and the rest of it, sort of, and doing fringe theatre and getting myself onto telly eventually.
What did you learn from being part of that set? Because I think every generation has, once in a while, a kind of petri dish of people that come together that are just formidable. And Cambridge really offered that, didn't it? Certainly on the comedy circuit, great comedic actors, not necessarily stand-ups, but people that went on to write, create, perform great comedy. Who were your greatest teachers there, and what were you taught by them?
Well, you get nerve, actually, because you have to sort of you have to go stand up and sort of create something or be part of something in front of a very critical audience who you get howled off, and so you've got to have that ability, not ability, that you have that nerve to do it. It's not safe, you just sort of you expose yourself a bit, and in terms of reaching the depths of ignominy when things don't go right, and you get a taste for what it's like to die completely on stage, and you vow never to let that happen again. And we did die comprehensively in various shows. We once went to the University College London Summer Ball in Gower Street, which and we had we were meant to be on at midnight, having done the show up in Cambridge that night, and so we came down to London immediately after doing it at the Arts Theatre in Cambridge, and came to do the ball in at University College London. So being a ball, and this was 1977, 76, I think it was, and we did. And being a ball, of course, we were wearing dinner jackets and bow ties and stuff like that. But we hadn't quite realised that the zeitgeist had moved on, shall we say, in 1977 in London. And so we arrived at the smartly dressed in our everything in Gower Street to the University College London, and we saw the poster, which said The Fabulous Poodles, which are a rock band of Ronnie Golden, and The Cambridge Footlights, and The Jam. I wish I'd kept the poster. I mean, yeah, it would have been fantastic. But and so we were meant to be on at midnight, the Poodles were late. And I had said to Ronnie Golden, thank you very much, because the Poodles were so late that we went on at 2:00. And that was the point when The Jam was supposed to be on. So everybody coming into the theatre were expecting to see The Jam. They saw these punces in a jam coming on to entertain them. We got howled off. I mean, we got things thrown at us. We got things, I don't think we were spitting, but they were just, I mean, we got comprehensively smeared to the stage. I mean, it was just sort of, you know, just like, yeah. And we only lasted about 10 minutes. And Jimmy Mulville at one point was saying, look, if you don't stop throwing stuff, we're going to just, and suddenly the hail came away. So when you've completely been rinsed by an audience, you understand what it's like. And then you sort of spend your rest of your career trying to stop that happening again.
Wonderful. So you're no appetite to be the Jam's warm-up again.
No, it's just, I do have a fondness for them as a result of that.
Across the years, how many times have your paths crossed with the likes of Jimmy, Emma, Hugh, Stephen, that you were a part of that Cambridge Footlights crew with?
Well, I wasn't quite. I mean, they were a couple of years below me. I mean, we got together and toured and stuff like that. And I do see them. I mean, I'm currently only seeing Hugh at funerals now at the moment. But so I seem to be bumping into him at such occasions. The others, yeah, I mean, see Stephen and Martin. I've just been in Los Angeles and seen Martin, and it was lovely to see him. But Yeah, I mean, they've taken their path, and I've taken mine, and we bump into each other like that. But they went off and did a sketch show called Al Fresco with Ben Elton, up in Manchester, and that was sketches, and then Jimmy was doing a thing called Who Dares Wins, and I was involved in Who Dares Wins in a small way, but. It was sketches, and I'd really wanted to, you know, to do what I do. And I remember Stephen ringing up, and I was doing a pub theatre in Chelsea. I was in the late 80s. I was doing a 2-hour monologue on cannibalism. Yeah, and so and I remember Stephen ringing up and saying, "How's the world of tragedy?" And I thought, "Shut up!" You know, just start stopping, so patronizing. I'm doing what I want to do, and so I was taking that path, and that's the way I wanted to go.
Wonderful. Okay, time for my third and final question for you, Robert. Oh. I wanted to know what being the father of 4 daughters has taught you in an all-female house over these years, about the difference between the two sexes.
Oh, I mean, the trouble is I know no different. I when my third daughter, our third daughter was born, I remember trying to get a bit of male influence in my life, and I immediately joined the Brixton Snooker Centre. I don't know, that was maybe in a reaction to having a, but I mean,
was that your answer? So you were, I must point out at this point, all 4 of your daughters were born and raised to some degree in Brixton, I'm walking distance from there right now, Robert. I know it very well, but I'm imagining it was very different back then to the Brixton of today.
Well, we moved in 85, which was just after the second riots. I remember driving through Brixton on 81 on that very hot night, and I was just going past the police station, all these people with masks, and it was all starting to kick off, and people were throwing stuff. But the 85 riots were less political, perhaps. Frank Johnson's sports shop got raided. I'm not sure that was political. There was still trouble. Anyway, we moved in shortly after those riots, and I said to my next door neighbour, "Was he affected by the riots?" And he said, "No. They were 200 yards away," which was. but it was different. I mean, it has changed a lot. I'm speaking from Brixton, in fact. There we are, I enjoyed it. I adore Brockle Park and in a book club here and lots of friends here.
So you still are based in Brixton as well.
Yeah, well I stay here quite a lot. Yeah.
So Brockwell Park, that's again, I mean, I was there just yesterday. I love it there. But the scene of so many artists over the years, you know, Adele sat there and wrote the first of her albums, I think, in Brockwell Park.
Did she? Right. Yes. I think there's all sorts of sightings to be had in Brockle Park. I mean, I love the walled garden. I've learned so many lines in Brockle Park. I just go round and round and round trying to learn the lines. It's a place I love, really.
I train in the gym there alongside your friend of mine, Jimmy Nesbitt.
Jimmy goes, does he? Yeah, right. Okay.
Jimmy used to turn up in years and years ago when we first started going to the gym. Jimmy used to do that thing before gym wear was a thing. He'd turn up in what looked like old man sports kit. You know, like, do you wear that for the garden and the gym? It was that kind of thing.
One of those very baggy tracksuits with fleece on the inside.
Or just like shorts with a bit of paint on that you might have done some decorating in.
Okay, well, it was just a conversation opener, probably.
But it's a fun place to live, I think. I love it. I love it around here. Yeah. But I wondered what it was like raising daughters around there and then taking them off for a very different life in the country at a certain point in their upbringing. And also, how have they educated you, do you think, about
I'm not sure
to be female?
How I can answer this, Kate. I mean, it's sort of... it sort of happens. I mean, I wouldn't say, yeah, I mean, I can't really make any sort of claim for that, because it's just sort of part of us, and I haven't sort of I don't stand outside it and look in. I don't see how life would have been different if I'd had sons. I don't see. Of course, I see things through their eyes, and I see the difficulties of so much. But I know no different. I mean, I've never modelled how a family life and how things should be. I've never had great plans and things like that. What I do is I can never book a holiday, and so it means that we've never had a family life which with other families going on holidays. So many people have regular, so they always go to a certain place and they always go at a certain time of year with a certain load of people, which is comforting and wonderful in some ways. If it works, and we've never had to do that, so it's always been slightly sort of ad hoc things that are going on, and so we've never had those sort of that stability of contact with, you know, people and gangs and so forth like that, because I've been so sort of freelance, really.
Yeah, I do get. I suppose I guess for me, I'm raising a boy, a teenage boy. So I do a lot of driving to and from football matches, for example. And we get out of the car after maybe an hour's drive, and there's three, four lads in the car. And then my son will say, "Why do you ask so many questions?" I was like, "It was an hour's drive. It's called a conversation."
Yeah, like,
we just don't do that. I was like, oh, because a car full of women would have talked. We would have just talked.
Yes, yes. This is very difficult, because casual encounter, I mean, it's not something that the English do that well. I mean, of course, the Irish, you can fall in and out of conversation easily, and you don't have to invite them for Christmas, you know, which is what the English are always very worried about, what's going to happen if you speak to somebody for too long. I mean, I said to somebody on the train the other day, I said, "Is this train for Hastings?" And he looked at me as, I don't know, he said, it was sort of, who are you? What right have you to ask me a question, sort of thing? I thought, oh, come on. You know, and so I love casual encounter. I like sort of shooting the breeze with someone just for a few minutes, and then, you know, and then parting ways. And I think that the art of casual encounter is lost in people's sort of anxiety about strangers and all the rest of it.
Before I let you go, I just wondered, any updates on a possible next chapter with Cold Feet? Because I know you're probably as keen as the rest of us to see them return at some point, aren't you?
I spoke to the writer, Mike Bullen, not so long ago, and I said, oh, come on. You know, I mean, the fact is, of course there are no plans, but I sort of see that the sort of artistic juice in it, in the sense that there's 26 is the 30th anniversary, or 30th anniversary, 30 years since the pilot. The pilot went out in 97, but we filmed it in 96. And as 30 years on, I mean, it's sort of those characters, people have, I mean, we've seen us through, and from our, some of us in our late 20s to some of us in our early 70s, you know, by that stage. And so that's a long time to see how characters are, and it's sort of, in a sense, it's the sort of the dramatic comedy, the comedy drama equivalent of Seven Up.
I was going to use that as a reference, because I think Seven Up, for anybody that doesn't know, is a documentary that ITV, many, many, many decades ago, where every 7 years they would follow a bunch of people and update people on where they were at 7 years on, 7 years on, 7 years on. And it was fascinating as a piece of television, as a social experiment. And I think we're all so invested in, I mean, like, you know, when the last Cold Feet came back and David had cheated and was with somebody else, I was really pissed off with you. I was like, no! No, I mean, that's how much I believed it.
Yes, yes. Well, it's strange, isn't it, with the audience for television. there is the conceit that it's real, and you try and engage people. On stage, of course, everyone knows it's rubbish. Everybody knows it's just it's not real. But and you're being invited for the evening to believe it's real. When I did in Downton, when I left Lady Edith at the altar, I had some vicar came up to me and said, "How could you have done that?" And it wasn't me. But it does. TV characters do strike sort of personally with people, and people come up to me in the sort of intervening years of Kilfi before the last more recent outing of it. People said, "Well, we courted during that show. It means a lot to us. A lot of it was about commitment, and it was an entertainment, but it did serve as a marker for them and their relationship in a rather wonderful way.
Do you know what it was and remains for me? It's like a really good hour long catch up about your group of friends on the phone with one of your girlfriends on a Sunday night, and it would be like, "So what's happened to so and so then? No way. And then what? He did not." No. And that is an episode of Cold Feet for me. It's like the best catch up phone call ever with a group of friends that I'm not friends with, but I wish I was.
Oh, it's really interesting. And at its best, it can be funny and sad in the same sentence as well. When that works,
that was always its beauty, I think.
I think there's a reason for doing the sort of the third age of Cold Feet, if you like, which doesn't have to be misery. I mean, there's so much about getting old, which people go sort of in deterioration and stuff like that. But there's also great warmth of association and humour to be had. Which I think can be mined through those characters. It may be. I mean, that's just me saying it. I mean, I'm not writing it. So
surely a streamer would be thinking, "Well, if ITV aren't biting, I'm going to get in there."
I think there's grounds for it. I think there's a market for it, if you want to put it in cold ways. But I also think artistically and creatively, those characters, I say, have juice in them, and I think they we could see them again, but it's not my decision.
If only it were.
If only it was you.
If only it was me pressing that green light, Robert.
You go and run a streamer.
You'd be working to the grave if I had my way. Trust me, the lot of you.
Very happy.
Thank you so much for your time today. It's been my absolute pleasure to talk to you. And continued success with Geoffrey Bernard Is Unwell. There, as you said earlier, there will be more dates added. If people want to follow the show or grab tickets for the show, where do they sign up for updates and news?
Geoffrey with a J, geoffreyplay.com. And they will hear about new gigs that are coming on, so they can jump in and book them before they go.
Go and have a proper old school night out in Soho. You may even end up in Jerry's with Robert. And good luck to your livers if you are. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kate. Love you.
What a fascinating man he is. And if you'd like to listen in on other episodes with fellow Cold Feet castmates, we've got John Thompson and the brilliant Faye Ripley in our back catalogue, alongside other great actors like Luke Evans, Alan Cumming, Jason Fleming's in there, Mark Bonner, Daisy May Cooper, Kerry Godleyman, Hannah Waddingham, and so many more. I'll be back on Tuesday with another treasure from the cellar. Until then, thanks, as always, for listening. Remember that you can always find us on Instagram. So go follow us at @whitewine_questiontime. And also, please hit the follow button on Spotify. Thank you so much for listening.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.